Welcome to another episode of the Tactical Leadership Podcast, where we focus on building better businesses. I believe in order to be the best leader that you can be, you must be willing to be the first follower and have a servant mentality when you're in a leadership position. If you want to be the best leader that you possibly can be sure to stay tuned and listen to industry leaders and hear how they built winning cultures in their own businesses.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of Tactical Leadership. Today, I'm going to be speaking with Bill Coletti, and we're going to be talking about how he helps control risk reputation and how after a bad incident, he can help you shift the mindset of reputation management. But before we begin, I want to remind you that this show is brought to you by Knightly Productions. If you want to start creating content that delivers, head over to knightly.productions and see how we can help you create that tactical content that will break through all the noise of the virtual world. Bill, welcome to the show, my friend.
Hey, Zach, it is awesome to be here. I'm looking forward to a great conversation, man.
Man, I'm super excited about this because this goes back to the core of me starting my first business, risk management, so many different things attached to crisis communications. And we'll probably get off on a nerd streak or two tangent about this because I love it from my physical background. And now you were bringing in your side of things, which is reputation management, where it really focuses on like how to take an incident into a positive PR spin or how do you rebound from something like that. And to give the audience just an idea about how you got into this, your reputation management, crisis communications, and professional development expert. You're a keynote speaker, Wall Street Journal risk and compliance panelist. You're best-selling author of Critical Moments, The New Mindset of Reputation Management. You have more than 25 years of experience managing high-stakes crisis issues management and media relations from Fortune 500 companies and global political campaigns. Essentially, what that means is from the worst of the worst incidents, you can help somebody come back and rebound with a positive reputation. Besides that, and before we delve too far into that awesome work, tell the audience a little bit about yourself.
Oh, that's awesome. Well, thank you for all of that. So yeah, I think we help people come back exactly the way you said it. But just like any path of recovery, redemption, or change, the patient has to be willing to go. So I can't do it by myself. And you know how that works. Anytime you do training, you need to have a willing participant. So, you know, I grew up running political campaigns, started as a senior in high school, did politics for the first 20 years or so of my career, and then transitioned to doing the work of corporate communications and a corporate strategy and applying the skill sets of politics to corporations, and then ultimately doing what we're doing now of working on reputation management. So it's been an interesting arc starting with politics as a kid way back when.
And what I think a lot of people, and I'm really curious about this, because the level of leadership that an organization like yours has to have in these moments that have become very emotional, right? A crisis, people start driving off emotion. When people reach out to you and start talking to your organization, start speaking with you, is it post-crisis, something's already happened, or is this proactively they're planning for avoidance of crisis?
Yeah, you know, it's simplistic. They either call me before, during, or after. Now, that is not a remarkably keen insight because there's not much else in life before, during, or after. You know, the big bulk of what we do as a firm from a revenue standpoint is during, you know, people calling in a crisis. They've gotten a referral to us from an attorney or for someone else that's been through something similar, and they need help now. And that's basically where we're an emergency room physician. And so we come in and are triaging and really trying to solve in the moment. Often we get called after, where someone realizes there's been a crisis, they've had a crisis, they know that a crisis is inevitable for their industry or they've observed it, and they want to do some planning and preparation, but crisis was typically the catalyst. So that's after, and that's where we get into reputation management and readiness. And then probably the smallest basket are folks that really just as a part of their checklist, they want to do some sort of proactive thought process, hadn't really been in a crisis. You know, those are pretty, pretty rare people. And so last example is people, you know, working with your family doctor, you need to go see them every now and then because you got a family history. There are a few people that are very, very concerned about their health that don't need any prompting. And those are the folks on the front end. So we range from emergency room physicians to family doctors to a little bit of brain surgery every now and then.
And I absolutely love that. Thank you for putting that context around it, because I think a lot of people kind of misunderstand. I know from my physical security background, it was, I would say 90% of people, it's post-crisis, right? There's very proactive planning attached to it, which blows my mind, because post-crisis, the lawsuits have already happened, the bad's already hitting you, right? And in order to lead a client through a situation like that, you have to have a special something about you as a leader that they'll be willing to follow in such a high emotional driven time. How would you describe that process? How would you describe yourself as a leader, your organization as a leader that helps these clients through that?
Yeah. So I think it's twofold. One is that I've always been told and now appreciate for myself that I've always just been sort of the calm spot in the middle of a spinning wheel. And whether as a little kid or as a teen and kind of holding my family together, just making sure that all the brothers and sisters are talking with mom and dad. And if anybody's in a family dynamic, they know that things can get a little weird. And so I'm usually been that still point in the middle, and then just really have always done that professionally. And so I think people look to that when they're in crisis, but I think that in and of itself isn't enough. I think then there's the second component, which is experience and expertise and this notion of pattern recognition. And I think one of the things that makes me good at what we do is this notion I've seen a lot. So there is pattern recognition. And you know that from both your law enforcement and military background, is that's why we study history. That's why we go deep into the movements and tactics of your opposition, because you can learn a lot. But that's pattern recognition. And you can get pattern recognition by doing something for 25 years, or you can get pattern recognition through some training. So I think people look for two things. One, just the general stillness in the middle of the spinning wheel, which I think we see that in people. And then the other is this notion of pattern recognition or experience. You put those two together, and people typically find value in what we deliver because of those two things.
And I love, you're talking about reputation, and it's something that I think the new hot word among the millennials, it all turns into this, and the younger generation is like branding, right? What is your brand? What is your brand experience? And a big thing to me, the way I articulate brand is like, it's your virtual reputation. You have to have the reputation in the first place, and then you just put it virtually, and that becomes your brand, quote unquote, that people see, where a lot of what you're talking about from the political side, you know, one bad PR post turns into wildfire. Right. And then your virtual reputation, doesn't matter what your in-person good reputation is, that virtual reputation like dissipates. Right. Is that something y'all really delve into, of that like branding as well, where like the reputation building goes into that quote unquote hot topic word branding?
Yeah. So we really don't. In fact, I try to make a really interesting distinction, because I think it's important. And I think it's important the more sophisticated you get in thinking about this. So the phrase that I really like is, a company owns its brand, but the public owns its reputation. All right. So I don't know about you, but I know where you live in the country. And so I don't shop at BP. BP gas station is just not convenient for me. It's not on my way home. And when I was going to an office, it's not where I went. I just didn't go to a BP. It wasn't in my neighborhood and whatnot. So I'm not a brand affiliated customer of BP. But being in the South, you know about Deepwater Horizon, you know about what BP did in the Gulf of Mexico and impact on Louisiana and the Florida Gulf Coast. So I have a clear perception about the reputation of BP. And so I make a distinction with brand, which is about where a company controls that. I can do things. If I was a BP customer, there are things that they could do to make me a more loyal customer. Change prices, do price promotions, make me an affinity guest, whatever they want to do. Anybody can do that. The Apple Store, Reebok, Starbucks, everybody does that. Insurance companies. But if I'm not a purchaser or in that purchasing consideration set, we still need to give some thought to public perception and public reputation. And so I make a distinction between brand, which is about driving economic value to the organization, and reputation, which is about allowing you to have the license and the free will to operate your business as you see fit, impacted by the public. So there's a fine distinction there. So the answer is no, we as a firm don't do any brand work and what you would consider that classic space. It is much more in this public milieu as opposed to a consumer, customer, economic space.
And I love that distinction, which is why I asked the question. Like, I know there's got to be a greater distinction there where people kind of lump it all in, like myself, you know, brand just becomes brand, right? And people forget about like the reputation aspect of, at the end of the day, like a lot of people still do business with that handshake, right? I do a handshake because I know what your reputation is. And like, that's a huge piece of business. And a lot of what I think y'all focus on is like a framework of awareness, assessing, authority, action. You know, a lot of those things are like, you call it the 4A framework. Talk to us a little bit about that roadmap that you developed to help translate that to your clients.
Yeah. So I love telling the story. And so, and it's born out of what you and I were just talking about a minute or so ago. So I was with an amazing female CEO in New York, and she found us and had just been through a crisis. And so it was about a 7 days, 4 days of that kind of New York Times business section, Wall Street Journal, pretty big deal, certainly a big deal for her company and a relatively big deal nationally. And so we had been really closely connected. I was the senior advisor working with her leadership team, primarily the general counsel and some of their regulatory folks. And we were managing the crisis in a very much in a hand-to-hand combat type of way, responding to media and whatnot. During the course of that journey, I had this with the CEO, she and I were able to sort of really forged by fire, have a nice connection. And I kept talking about, when we get through this, we really need to focus on your reputation. We need to grow and expand your reputation. She's fighting a fire with me and politely heard what I was saying, but had no earthly idea what I was talking about because I was full of kind of consultant mumbo jumbo, and she had no idea what the heck I was talking about. And so finally, we're at the end of this and we're kind of exiting, and my time, you know, we finished and life moved on and we moved on. And she said, "Bill, this has been awesome, but I remember you talking about reputation. What do you mean by that? And how do I manage reputation? I just don't understand it." And she said, "What I need is I need a paradigm. I need a framework to understand it the same way I understand marketing." And so there's this old adage that came from the 1960s of the marketing mix called the 4 P's of marketing: price, product, place, promotion. It was, like I said, built in the 60s, foundation of the marketing mix. We can argue whether it's valid in the age of digital or not, not really relevant, but price, product, place, promotion are the four fundamental elements of any marketing activity. And it was born out of the growth of the marketing trade separate from sales, because sales, as you know now, is very different than marketing. And then she wanted that. She wanted me to come up with and help her understand reputation the same way that she understood, very smart MBA, the way she understands marketing framework. So with that mandate, I went home, got on the plane, flew home, cocktail napkin and pen in hand, and mapped out this process of the 4 A's of reputation management. And what the 4 P's do, the 4 P's of marketing, or any other management paradigm, it lets you assign manpower and assign budget. And in corporations, that's what makes a framework, that what makes a system or a process, whether it be HR, janitorial supplies, legal, how you manage your litigation portfolio, how you manage your security on campus, whatever the case may be, there is manpower, who are the people, and then how much money are they going to need? And so the 4 A's is a mechanism to let people manage something very ephemeral, like reputation, and break it down into that sort of notion of awareness. Who are we? What do we stand for? Assessment. Let's go ask the public and ask our employees, who should we be? What is important to you? Authority. You take the learning from those first two steps, take it to your leadership team and say, here's what we've learned and here's what we want to do. Then there's a blue line on the model that I've created. Stop and reflect. Then execute your action. Because too often in reputation, since it is difficult to understand the concept, too often people like me and other well-intentioned consultants run and say, you just need to go jump on the LGBTQ bandwagon. You need to go write a bigger check to the United Way. You need to go criticize President Trump. You need to go do this, you know, support Black Lives Matter, without going through this logical process. And regardless of where you are in a corporation, if I launched a new product at a company and we just jump to action because there's a logical framework of the way we introduce, you know, a new ballpoint pen. There is a logical process of testing and asking the customer, getting budget and buy-in, and then jumping to action. There's no reason why reputation, soft, granted, you and I just talked about the softness of it. There's no reason why it can't go the same sort of logical framework that litigation, janitorial supplies, HR, product development, security gets managed the same way. So that was the birth of 4A's, which is the what I wrote my book about, but it was the birthplace of that was out of this foundational premise, which I'm sure you're aware of from way back when, of the 4 P's of marketing. And the 4 P's of marketing transformed marketing back in the day.
Yeah, and I absolutely love how you outline that framework, because when you talk about just taking that act, you have to do this, and it's immediately, well, people are going to see, the public especially, it's going to see through that hollow act of you throwing $1 million towards United Way, right?
Totally. Totally. And authenticity is this new word. It's not a new word, but everybody talks about authenticity, and you can't manufacture that. That has to come through this process of awareness, assessment, authority. Can we really walk the walk? Because I know you know lots of leaders that talk the talk, but don't walk it. And that's you have to go through that process even more so with something that's more ephemeral and soft like this than other management paradigms within corporations.
Yeah, I absolutely love that you put that context on it, because so often you see that, and it's so frustrating where it almost seems like a slingshot effect, right? Like all of a sudden you're on the other side of the spectrum. It's like, well, I know that's not real, so I'm really not buying into this story that you're attempting to communicate. And I think a big piece of what you're talking about is that communication from you to the client, from the client to the public. You throw in investors, right? You throw in all these other, the board. There's so many different factors where communication in a crisis is, I would argue, probably the most important thing, I would imagine, where all of y'all have to communicate effectively, get on the same page, get all the communication out. The voice has to be united. Talk to us a little bit about like the style of communication, or how you get all those different pieces of the puzzle into the communication world, because that's just a crazy concept to think about how much you have to communicate in that space.
It is. And you know, it's interesting. So I love your background, and it's so, and I'm so, as a practitioner, always so honored to talk to folks that come from this linear military foundation, because chain of command means a ton to you. I mean, that is a bedrock principle of the way shit happens.
It's 100%
through chain of command. All right. And right. That's just how it gets done. Not a lot of incentive for entrepreneurism. There's not a lot of incentive for that. Now, nope, maybe
here's your box. You better stay in it.
Exactly. Now, maybe in a battlefield situation and six guys are trying to figure out how to do something, maybe there's room for entrepreneurism, but those are rare examples of when it happens. And so this process of chain of command is really, really critical. So we often try to apply in what I do, which is corporate communications and this notion of reputation, we try to apply some of those principles. So for me, the equation in corporate communications context, the equation between and the distinction between good and great communications is speed. So speed is the key differentiator. How do you get fast? So it's an equation. It is mission and values plus chain of command equals speed. If I don't know who I am and what I stand for, what are my values as an organization? You mentioned a series of stakeholders, the board, my investors, my customers, my employees. If I don't know my mission and values, who I stand, what I stand for, and who I stand for, you'll be slow. Add that with a clunky chain of command where you don't know who needs to be in the room, both formally and informally, you will never be fast. You can't be fast. It's just like you and I on a track. We can't be fat. We cannot will ourselves to run a 10-second 100 meter. We have to train and practice and make sure we got the will and do it over years and blah, blah, blah. Lots of things we need to do. But if we want to be good at crisis communications, we want to be good in critical moments, speed is the differentiator. It's what do you stand for, mission and values, plus chain of command. And I make a distinction in chain of command. And this is where mine I'm curious your reaction. That's somewhat different than in the military. In a corporate context, there's an org chart and there is a formal chain of command that's very obvious to anybody, is that I can see the order and logic. But very often there's an informal chain of command of outside legal help, outside communication strategists like me, your insurance company that's there, a board member's wife that gives you a lot of grief about, well, why aren't we saying something about sexual harassment? So there's lots of informal aspects of chain of command. And I'm agnostic to that. I don't think companies have to be Puritans about that, because those are real. All of those are real influences. So when I look at chain of command, I add that informal component to it as well. So I'd love to hear your reaction. Is that formal chain of command, you salute that and that makes tons of sense to you. But my hunch is there are probably some elements of this informal chain of command that impacts speed to decision-making.
You know, I love that you put that, because it's interesting from my perspective. We're very similar in crisis consulting, where I'm physical security, you're that reputation side, right? So it would almost be a great collaboration between our two organizations, where I focus on how do we make it safer for people, like physically safer. And then you're worried about that outlook and how to show what I'm doing really translates to that message, right? And as a consultant now, the reason I started that organization is because I saw the shortcomings of law enforcement, as well, I was still a police officer. I saw the shortcomings of law enforcement and wanted to be the bridging gap, because law enforcement is a piece of the puzzle, right? And a lot of people see it as the end all be all. Law enforcement management themselves see themselves as the end all be all. We are the answer, not a piece of the puzzle. So when you're talking about this informal chain of command, even in law enforcement, there's that very direct chain of command. And very rarely do they allow an outside source to come in and say, here's this informal objective viewpoint of how we're doing things improperly. And I really saw this, to share even further into that, when you mentioned BLM earlier, of this jump on all of a sudden bandwagon movement. And if you don't take the steps proper to show that you're authentic about that, people see through it. And I was on the SWAT team at this police department, and about a month after Ferguson happened, we shot and killed a black male that was attempting to run over one of our SWAT officers. Everybody came out on the back end of things. There were indictments, but everybody came out where legally it ended up being a lawful act on the police side. And zero was said by that police department for months. And Black Lives Matter came, Jesse Jackson, Black Panthers, you name the organization, came to Atlanta and protested and rioted. And what ended up happening was that chief at the time turned into, oh, we support everything, do whatever you want, riot, do everything, tore up the entire city, invalidated the people that lived there. And then the people that actually care, the actual Black Lives Matter movement and the people that started that, called him out on, you don't really care, because it's just, and it was amazing to actually firsthand see that after a crisis incident, where those people have amazing values attached to that organization and saw straight through what that police chief did, because they saw it as lack of authenticity and just, oh, I want to get past this quote unquote situation, which means he essentially downplayed the situation.
I'm going to spin my way out of it. Absolutely.
Yeah. And that's where I love what you're talking about, because I saw it then. And a couple of years later is when I started that business. It's like, it's just not the answer. Like, you have to have that bridging gap, those steps like you're talking about, because if you don't manage that properly, all of a sudden that situation got so much more inflammatory because we didn't handle it properly in the reputation piece that you're talking about.
Yeah. Yeah. Such a great, wonderful illustration of that point. And, you know, what we want to try to do is to expand further on your great question. Is that I've built my firm around this premise of three basic risks. We have three types of risks. Now, there's a fourth one that I want to talk about, but there's three basic risks. There are strategic risks, and these are all around the concept of reputation. There are strategic risks, preventable risks, and external risks. So strategic risks are things I mean to do as a company to improve my economic value, to improve my economic situation. So I'm going to close a factory. I'm going to lay off people. I'm going to raise prices. I'm going to use red dye number 5. Whatever I'm going to do in my process, I've decided I'm going to do this for some strategic benefit because it is going to increase the economic value of my enterprise. Basic capitalistic concept. Preventable. There should not be metal shavings in hamburger patties. That simply should not happen. That is preventable, and there is technology that can stop that. That simply should not happen. So that's a preventable risk. And then you have external risks. You and I can debate whether we could stop every active shooter. I don't think you can. There are plenty of vulnerabilities. You can try to be better, try to be safer, but those are external threats. A hurricane, you know, you live in the South. We're not going to do anything about hurricanes and tornadoes and force majeure weather events. Those are external events. All three of those, strategic, preventable, and external, dictate a different type of response and a different type of mindset and behavior by the leadership team in each one of those. So one of the first things we try to do is how do we figure out what do we do and how do we respond? What is the risk that we're dealing with? All right. So if you take it back to your example of the Atlanta Police Department and or your situation in Atlanta and the SWAT team and whatnot, that was a strategic risk. There was a conscious decision based on tactical imperatives that they needed to stop that situation. Okay. Wasn't external. I mean, it didn't come at them. They knew they were putting themselves in a dangerous situation, made a strategic decision in order to do that. What happens in that same parallel, and I'm conflating public safety and corporations to a certain extent, is that in a strategic risk situation where I intended to do something for superior economic value, my response in the crisis is not to apologize. My response is, I'm sorry that I didn't do a good enough job explaining why we are doing this. I'm sorry I didn't do a good enough job of defending or having you understand. So go back to, we're deciding to lay off the third shift, or we're deciding to close this campus, or whatever the case may be. Shame on us that in a strategic risk, we didn't do a good enough job explaining it. Preventable hamburger, you know, metal shavings and hamburger patties, or a bad cop doing bad things and you've known about it for a long time, that is preventable. All right. That should not happen. There should be mechanisms and systems just like metal shavings and hamburger patties where that shouldn't happen. And if it does happen, you apologize for it, you fire people, you fix it, and you get back to business as fast as you can. External, I can't apologize for a hurricane. We're all in it together. But I can get back to business as fast as I can. I can be as helpful as I can in the marketplace. I can do things that are my unique ability. We have represented Home Depot. They are great. They have nothing to do with hurricanes, okay? But they know they need to get back online really, really fast. And that's where they're spending their time because they need to help people immediately after a hurricane. And so they can't, if the store shut down or flooded or whatever, they're not like all freaked out about the crisis and the reputation. They're like, everybody shut down. We're just going to focus on getting 2x4s to people that need them as fast as we can. So understanding risk, if you understand that paradigm about speed, the next thing to understand is this understanding about risk. How does risk work? And so getting clear on that is critical.
And I think that's a great thing to understand, because I speak from my background, military and law enforcement, and I've seen the critical incidents happen from that perspective, started my side of the physical security side to help prevent that type of stuff. But you're right, you can't ever stop that, because most of the time you can't ever expect that to happen. And when all of a sudden something like that happens and there needs to be a quick pivot, right? You say you're sorry, should have done X, Y, and Z better. And I feel like there's part of the A's is that action attached to, you have to act on something. A great strategy, a great idea, you know, having motivation means nothing until you actually act on things, right? So kind of explain the power behind taking those actions once you've strategized them and once you have everything in the framework in place. What's the power of actually like acting on something? And to that extent, is it something that you act on with like just absolute knowledge that it's going to work and this is the right direction, which means you act even harder in that fashion?
Yeah. Wow. Great. Really fabulous question. So let me sort of unpack it a little bit. So I often get asked the question is, why does a good reputation matter? All right. And so through the whole course of this conversation, we've just sort of assumed that a good reputation is good. Okay. So we could probably be a little bit more empirical and prove that a good reputation matters. Cause I mean, I know plenty of rich jerks, okay, that don't have a good reputation. Okay. So having a good reputation actually does matter. And we can prove that, but here are three reasons why. You know, first is you want to get the benefit of the doubt. All right. So that if and when there is a situation, take BP or take Starbucks, if and when there is a situation where there is a question about your reputation, you want people to say, well, hey, that's not the company I know. And you want to get the benefit of the doubt. And that only comes through building a good, deep reservoir that actually builds up what I call goodwill that organizations can dip into sometimes when they have a bad reputation. You can think about that. I know plenty of law enforcement jurisdictions in the United States is that there's the others that don't have a reservoir to dip into. And there are some that have really deep. And when something goes down, the chief can say, you know, that's not us. We don't do that. And here's what we're doing to fix it. Others are like, yeah, I fully expect that from XYZPD. I fully expect that from them. So the first thing you get is you get the benefit of the doubt from a really good reputation. The second thing is that particularly if you're in a B2B type context, a B2B type company, it breaks ties. Okay. Assuming everything's equal on price and product and service delivery, a strong reputation breaks a tie. Okay. So when you choose a bank, okay, you got a handful of them that are close to you. You got a handful of them that offer the same competitive rates. They both have online banking. But if there's something about their reputation, that's why you'll choose that. So it helps break ties. A strong reputation breaks the ties. For a publicly traded company, there is empirical evidence, particularly with this millennial generation, that stock price raises for companies with stronger goodwill. So there is empirical evidence that companies, again, big publicly traded companies with strong reputations do better because the consumer, the public, the trading public, and this week we've learned a lot about the power of the trading public, drive stock price higher for publicly traded companies that have a strong reputation. So those are three really empirical reasons why a good reputation matters and why you need to pay attention to it, nurture it, and focus on it in order to sort of expand it. The one I really like is think of Chick-fil-A. I know I can just tell by looking at you. I know you're a fan. They're in your hometown. They're just
the Lord's chicken, my
that
friend.
That is the best there Atlanta. Is right there. Chick-fil-A is awesome. But the Truitt family has social beliefs that could be construed not mainstream, okay? Particularly about LGBTQ and some abortion issues that are not mainstream. And this is, I don't want to call balls and strikes on either side. That's not my point. But their license to operate in New York or San Francisco is stymied, not because of their business model, not because they're a great trading partner, not because of their amazing product. Their ability to expand into New York or San Francisco, just pick two cities, has been and is stymied because of those reputational issues. So thinking about those things are really important for an organization. It goes back to mission and values about what you really stand for. So long, convoluted answer. I'm not sure I answered your question precisely, but I think the point is that reputation matters because it matters to people that matter to you. And so that's why you got to focus on it.
Yeah, I love that. And it's interesting you bring up Chick-fil-A because I remember obviously being here in Atlanta, like that was such a flamethrower situation when they stood on their mission and values. And I want to kind of highlight that because I feel like that's something that in my situation in the police department, the chief didn't have a clearly defined mission and value. This is how we're going to act. And because that wasn't clearly defined of this is who I am, this is who we are as an organization, that culture wasn't set. Whereas you look at somebody like Chick-fil-A, their mission and values are plastered, right? And there is, you can tell from the way they train their people. You can tell the way they treat their customer. Everything about their mission and values is very blatant in the way they operate, which, yes, it does obviously have some detractors in certain parts of the world. But in the South, like, I mean, there is respect because they stood for their mission and values. Agree or don't agree with their mission and values, they stood with them. How important is it to like really define those missions, those values that you want so you can stand on that? Does that earn an extra level of like credibility and reputation if you stand by that?
Absolutely. It all those things. So a couple answers to that. So first of all, amen, yes. So knowing that. So Patagonia, great company, make great clothing and it was intended to be used in the wilderness for survival, but it's now become more fashionable than anything. But that is a company that is really crystal clear on their values. They are all about the earth. They're all about their employees. They're all about the workers that make their products. And that pulls through on what they do. So I think mission and values absolutely matters. It doesn't need to be this sort of grandiose navel-gazing exercise of what do we stand for and do we want to save the world? Every company is not going to be Tom's Shoes. Every shoe you buy, we're going to give one away. Every company is not going to do that. And then the folks that work with you and listen to this podcast, that's not their paradigm. But if you think about mission and values, you mentioned earlier, and you didn't use the word, but you talked about stakeholders, sort of the people that sort of all the different influencers that you have. We talked about boards of directors and investors and whatnot. If we think about stakeholders in a better phrase that I prefer, of those that matter most. Okay, those that matter most. And so let's just take your chief of police. What matters most to me as an underpinning of my mission and values exercise? We've done it sometimes with like bracketology. Is it the mayor versus the head of the Black Lives Matter? Let's put them in a bracket. Who matters most to me? Is it my employees or the labor union that represents my employees, or is it the homeowners associations? Whatever. I don't know the law enforcement ecosystem well enough, but that's enough. Put them into a bracket and really ask yourself hard questions of who matters most. That will give you a very clear compass in a crisis of your mission and values. If you begin with understanding, and you've probably used the phrase or heard people talk about stakeholder mapping, you know, that's great. I love stakeholder mapping, but destination getting is a whole lot more important than mapping. All right. And so we need to actually know where we're going to do and use it. And that's where really understanding those that matter most is really important. So mission and values, amen. It can be a long, laborious process, but if you're not trying to be Tom's Shoes, who matters most? And think about that really hard. And it is okay to say, if you're a small business owner, I matter most. I'm going to pay myself, probably not great values, but whatever, be honest. Or my employees matter most, or my customers matter most, because when something breaks, it really helps you make fast decisions when you really have a clear understanding of that, about mission and values. Back to our law enforcement example, not having crystal clarity on that from the outset creates the problems that you went through and create the situations where we're making up as we go along, and we don't fully solve problems before they become crises.
And what I love about even using the bracketology aspect of it, as you break it all down, I really feel like it starts highlighting when you figure out who's most important. If you figure out who are you serving? What are you serving? And when you can determine who you're serving, then you can determine how you're serving and what can best do to serve that person or that group that is the most important, right? And when you look at everything you've put together, I mean, everything that for years you've been working on, this crisis management, reputation management firm, and helping others work through terrible situations, what are you serving toward in the long run? What's your legacy that you're trying to leave attached to these acts of service and serving your customers, serving your guests, clients, everybody that you're serving? What's that legacy look like for you?
Yeah. I want people not to need me. I want to leave organizations and individuals. We work with a few individuals, but mostly organizations. I want to leave them better than when they found me. Because as we said earlier, for the most part, people find us, and we are at our best when people are at their worst. And I want to make them better so that they don't need me. And so that, they really understand the mindset and the behavior and the why of what we do. That's what's really important. And so I want to leave people better, both individually as kind of our key contacts, the CEO, the head of communications, or organizationally. We want to leave people better than when we found them.
Yeah, I love that because it takes a level of, I don't even know the word for it, a level of service, I guess, to serve so much that you're not needed anymore. And I think that's such a great mission to be on, such a great legacy to leave. And Bill, I want to thank you for your time. Remind the audience, if they want to reach out to you, find out more about your organization, give them an idea of what the best way to go about that would be.
Yeah, awesome. So Bill Coletti, I'm not a whole lot of us around, so pretty easy to find on LinkedIn, pretty active there. Our firm's website is kith.co. And Zach, what we're going to do for folks listening to this podcast is we're going to set up a landing page, kith.co/tactical leadership. So people can sort of find some specific things that you and I talked about on this call, on this podcast. But LinkedIn, our website, email, Twitter, but it's just B Coletti, C-O-L-E-T-T-I, pretty ubiquitous and easy to find.
I love it. I want to remind the audience, as always, Bill's going to join us for Tactical Friday. We're going to unpack this, talk about his academy that is attached to teaching these tactics exactly, and we're going to get very granular on that piece of things for Tactical Friday. So be sure to tune back in this Friday and hear more from Bill. Thank you for your time today, my friend.
Thank you, Zach. Look forward to it.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of the Tactical Leadership Podcast, and I hope you got a ton of value out of what we talked about today. I also want to remind you that this show is brought to you by Knight Protection Services. If you're a leader in a small to mid-sized business that does $5 to $10 million a year in revenue and want to improve retention costs, which could actually add up to being twice your employee's salary, all through creating a safer work environment and saving up to 25% in insurance costs, be sure to visit knightprotectionllc.com.